Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, a lawyer from the Center for Reproductive Rights will talk about how they won an important case in Oklahoma and preserved women's right to privacy. Also, Bart Stupak spills misinformation so fast that even he can't keep up with it. And the Today Show asks if men and women can be friends. I'm sure you won't be surprised by their answer. Nona Willis Aronowitz hit the streets of New York and asked people to free associate on some words that are important to feminism. Here's what she got when she threw out the word choice.
Pro-choice.
Decision.
Decision.
Awards.
Making.
Wonderful.
Bicycle.
What?
Is yours?
Abortion. Abortion.
Mine.
Pro.
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 Mandatory.
Mint.
It's a fun, short video. Well worth checking out, especially for the funny stuff people have come up with when asked to free associate on the word woman. You know, my favorite thing about the whole situation with Bart Stupak, abortion, and healthcare reform has to be the way that Stupak continues to insist that he's not actually using this as a weapon to stop healthcare reform. But this is laughable for a number of reasons, the main one being that he lies through his teeth about what's in the bill, like he did on ABC.
Every enrollee in the Office of Personnel Management enrolled plan, every enrollee has to pay a minimum of $1 per month towards reproductive rights, which includes abortion.
Last week on the show, I pointed out that we know that anti-choicers are never happy with just attacking abortion, but always have to go after contraception. And that this is why it's good that pro-choice Democrats are taking a stand and swearing they won't vote for a bill with anti-choice language in it, because it at least holds the line and dissuades anti-choicers like Stupak from attacking contraception. Looks like I was right. Even the Senate bill, with the stupid separate rider stuff in it, is functionally a ban on insurance companies covering abortion. No one is going to get that rider, and I doubt insurance companies will offer it. Now that Stupak and his cronies have gotten that, looky here! They're claiming that all reproductive rights are, you guessed it, abortion. That includes contraception, cancer screening, STD treatments, and other things. Seems like Stupak is calling all those things abortion in an effort to separate women from the majority of health care they receive in their younger years. That's one reason I think he's dishonest about his intentions around health care reform. He's willing to tell bald-faced lies in an effort to stop this bill from going through. It's impossible at this point that he's so stupid that he believes his own lies. He's been told over and over and over again that the bill doesn't have federal funding for abortion. If he really cared about abortion, he'd stop misrepresenting the Senate bill. Hell, he was told on this very show by Kathleen Sebelius that this bill doesn't have federal funding for abortion.
This will not change the status quo on the policy of abortion. There will be no federal funding for abortion.
Well, as you know, Congressman Stupak simply disagrees. He says the Senate bill does do that and the president's proposal does do that. And unless it's changed, he and 11 other Democrats will not vote for it. So can you reach a new compromise?
George Stephanopoulos was gracious in showing us how bad the state of television journalism really is by asking Sebelius a question that may be the winner for the dumbest question ever asked on TV. First of all, implying that whether or not there's funding for abortion is a matter of opinion is strange. That's a question of fact. Either it's there or it's not, George. And it's not. And your job as a journalist is to report on the facts, not just give airtime to Bart Stupak's misinformation. Second of all, asking Sebelius if the president can compromise by doing something that has already been done is just stupid. How can they take out funding for abortion if it's not there? I suppose by shutting down women's health services completely and letting thousands and possibly millions of women die from lack of basic reproductive health care. But even if they did that, I have a funny feeling Bart Stupak would still mindlessly insist that it's all free abortions for everyone with vibrators and gay marriage certificates thrown in. The other reasons that I don't think we can trust Bart Stupak when he says that he wants to pass healthcare reform and is just getting stuck on abortion have to do with his connections to a highly conservative religious cult and his general dishonesty that makes believing anything he says impossible. The Rachel Maddow Show did a report on how Bart Stupak is deep inside the C Street family, something Stupak denies despite all evidence against his claims.
Now, you know, the family is known to be a very secretive group. And one of the things we noted as being a little weird in our coverage of this last night was that Bart Stupak keeps going out of his way to say that he's never signed an oath of secrecy around C Street. And indeed, in the letter to his constituents that his office gave to us today, he reiterates, quote, "I have never been asked to sign a contract or oath of secrecy concerning C Street or its residents." Why does he keep bringing this up? Turns out that not that long ago, when talking about C Street to the press, Bart Stupak told the Los Angeles Times that he kind of did abide by a code of secrecy when it came to C Street and the family. His quote to the LA Times when they asked him about C Street was this, quote, "We sort of don't talk to the press about the house."
There's been a suspicious amount of scrambling to hide the fact that Bart Stupak is a member of the family, that the C Street house is owned by the family, and basically that Stupak's behaving exactly as one might if one was a member of a secretive conservative organization pushing an anti-healthcare, anti-woman agenda. But, you know, needed a Democrat is covered to make it seem less like an overt agenda. The Maddow Show demonstrated that attempts to claim the family don't own the C Street house are undermined by the paper trail, and attempts by Stupak to claim he doesn't know anything about them are undermined by the fact that he had a room in that house, and that owners have overtly stated in the past, when they thought it didn't matter, that living there is contingent on being part of the family.
The reason this is important is because Bart Stupak continues to deny having anything at all to do with this secretive religious group, the family. But check this out. In 2002, when Bart Stupak was living at C Street, he's lived there for years. When he was living there in 2002, an associate of the family described for the press the arrangement that the family had with the members of Congress who lived at that house. And this is how the family described it. You ready? Quote, "A lot of men don't have an extra $1,500 to rent an apartment. So the fellowship house does that for those who are part of the fellowship." The LA Times noting that rent is $600 per month for each resident.
Remember, the amendment attached to the bill wasn't just the Stupak Amendment. It was the Stupak-Pitts Amendment, with Pitts being a Republican congressman who has been a prominent, long-term member of the family. The family exists as a religious organization, but they also exist to promote each other's careers and tell each other that they're the chosen people who deserve to rule over the rest of us. The advantages of being a member are great, and I imagine that those advantages make selling someone on an anti-healthcare reform agenda very simple indeed. I'd like to welcome Jennifer Mondino to the program. Jennifer is a staff attorney for the Center for Reproductive Rights. She's here today to talk about a legal victory in late February in Oklahoma, defeating a law that would severely undermine a woman's right to privacy with regards to abortion. Welcome to RealityCast, Jennifer.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Some listeners probably know about this law that would have required women in Oklahoma to release a bunch of private information to the public. But could you explain in detail what it was and what effect it could have had?
Sure. Well, the law had many different parts. That was sort of the basis of our lawsuit, that it had too many different parts for one law. But the reporting requirements part of it would have required any doctor performing an abortion or any doctor seeing a patient who he or she thought was having medical complications related to having had an abortion to answer a 10-page questionnaire. So the doctor would have had to go through this 10-page questionnaire, ask all of these different questions to the patient, covering things like their race, number of children, number of abortions they've had in the past, details about their personal relationship and their finances, really extensive and detailed questions. And then the doctor would have been required to report all of that information to the state, and the state would have gathered that information and published it on a website, and that website would have been, you know, searchable by anybody. So, you know, we think that that information, even though it wasn't going to include women's names, would have had detailed enough information that, you know, somebody who wanted to could have identified women that had had abortions in Oklahoma.
And the purpose of this law, what was the stated purpose, and what do you think was really kind of going on there?
Well, it didn't have a stated purpose. I think that the purpose of the law was just to, you know, further curtail women's ability to access abortion care in Oklahoma and, you know, further stigmatize and restrict abortion providers in that state. There's a very conservative, anti-choice legislature in power right now in Oklahoma, and we are seeing them pass, you know, many different kinds of restrictions on abortion in every legislative session. So I think this was just sort of their latest attempt. At the hearing, the judge, you know, said that he had been scrutinizing the law, and he thought that the purpose of the law was to ban sex-selective abortion. That was one part of the law, is that it would have prohibited people from having abortions if the abortion was motivated by a desire not to have a child of a particular gender. But, you know, even though the judge said that, that wasn't explicit in the law. That was just one piece, actually just a couple of paragraphs out of a very long.
What's interesting about this case is you didn't approach it from a privacy angle, but instead had the law overturned on a single subject rule. What's the single subject rule, and how did the center use it in this case?
The single subject rule is a rule in the Oklahoma Constitution. It's sort of unique. You know, a handful of states in the country have a rule like that. And the rule basically says that each new law has to address only one subject. And the idea is that it keeps legislators from being forced to vote up or down on parts of a law that they would have voted on differently if they had had an opportunity to meaningfully consider each of those laws separately. So we challenged this law on the grounds that it violated that rule because it had too many different parts rolled together into one law. And the reason that we decided to challenge it on those grounds is basically because we thought that we had such a strong claim under that rule. We had a successful challenge against a different Oklahoma law last fall, also on the single subject rule. And, you know, we felt that we had a very strong claim, and there was very strong law in Oklahoma supporting our claim. So, you know, rather than, you know, risk a longer lawsuit or a more unlikely outcome bringing in other kinds of claims, we decided to just go first with our very strongest claim, and luckily that turned out to be successful.
So why do you want to avoid challenging these laws on the right to privacy grounds in general?
Well, I wouldn't say that we are trying to avoid challenging laws on privacy grounds. I mean, you know, we are constantly challenging different laws on privacy grounds. But I think that when we were deciding what we were going to do, like, there's, you know, there's just some strategy in place. And ultimately what we're trying to do is, you know, protect women's ability to access reproductive health care and protect the few providers that are in the state. So we have to take that into account, you know, what's going to bring the most likely and the speediest outcome. And that was why we decided to go this route. You know, if it hadn't been successful, it's very likely that then we would have brought a new and different lawsuit bringing in claims on the merits. You know, luckily we didn't have to even try that route.
So I know you guys have a lot of experience with this, and you know that, like, when one pro-life group in one state gets an innovative idea such as this, it tends to spread like wildfire across other red states. Is this kind of thing being tested in? Do you see this this kind of law developing in other states? And if so, like, how do you plan to attack it?
That's a very good question. I was saying that the legislature in Oklahoma has been very aggressive in passing many different kinds of restrictions on abortion every legislative session, and I definitely think that they do serve as sort of a test case and a model for other anti-choice state legislatures. So I definitely think that there were a lot of people watching this law, and that if it had passed, it's likely that we would have seen some copycats in other conservative states around the nation. already, you know, we are seeing a few other states try to introduce bans on what's called sex-selective abortion. And, you know, there are also other states that are trying to pass very extensive and detailed abortion reporting requirements. So, you know, part of the reason that we think as an organization that it's important to challenge those laws is because we're hoping that it will send a message to other states that they can't get away with passing laws like that.
The sex-selective abortion thing, I don't quite understand that as a strategy. Is there any reason that they have to believe that that actually happens, or is that some kind of Trojan horse for other assaults on women's reproductive rights?
Yeah, I definitely think it's another Trojan horse. It's actually interesting. Like, if, you know, when we were preparing this also, we looked at the legislative history of the law and, you know, sort of all the legislators debating the law. And even one of the proponents of the law, you know, admitted in the hearing that he had no reason to believe that there were any sex-selective abortions taking place in Oklahoma. So it's definitely not a law that, you know, came into being because they were trying to address a problem that they knew existed in the state or really in the U.S. So I think it's just another way of making it difficult for abortion providers to do their job. You know, the law would have imposed really serious penalties on doctors who were found to violate that ban, criminal penalties. They could have lost their medical license. So you can imagine it's already a very, you know, challenging field for doctors to get involved in for many different reasons, stigma, you know, protesters, all of the different legal restrictions, and this is just another thing that might make doctors really hesitant to provide those services.
So how was it like in Oklahoma? Like, did you find that the pro-choice supporters were at least able to come out and give you some emotional support?
Yeah, I mean, actually that was sort of a very rewarding and nice aspect of working on this case. I think, you know, it's a very different thing to be working on these issues in New York City than it is in a state like Oklahoma. So I think our supporters were really committed and really active, and we did have a lot of people come out to the hearings, and a lot of people sort of contact us and contact the center saying that they were watching the case and that they were really happy about the outcome. So that's been terrific to see that. I think, you know, it's tough. It's tough to be supporting these rights in Oklahoma, but the supporters are definitely out there.
You can read about this case and other important work the Center for Reproductive Rights is doing at reproductiverights.org. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Now listen up.
You know what we feminists like to say? The only people that sexists think as little of as women are men. In the sexist worldview, men are permanently incapable of seeing women as full human beings and see us only as vaginas with legs, therefore relieving male sexual urges and to produce offspring. Of course, some men do see women this way, which is why there's an anti-choice movement at all, because they can't fathom the idea that a woman has a brain and makes choices. Sadly, some women buy that worldview too. But a lot of straight men have more complex, interesting attitudes towards women, and some believe, gasp, that we have more to offer than our reproductive organs. But when I have that masochistic desire to hear a counter-opinion on this subject, where else to turn but the Today Show? They brought on the hosts of a serious show called Whatever with Alexis and Jenny, and I get the impression that the whatever in their show isn't supposed to be the same whatever I uttered as I waved my hands at their inane blather. The topic is, can straight men and straight women ever be platonic friends? The answer is, are you silly? That would require believing men are capable of caring about a woman beyond her uterus and vagina and what it can do for them.
Men and women can be friends if that specific man and that specific woman are having sex. Otherwise, there's no way.
Or yeah. if one of them's gay.
Oh, sure.
I get the impression we're supposed to be charmed by this, but I'm not. They make it clear that they're forbidding not just relationships to male friends that are your friend friends, men that you might go to the movies or out to shows or out shopping or whatever with. They're also casting suspicion on women, especially married or otherwise partnered women, even allowing themselves to be alone in friends-like situations with coworkers, which basically could ruin the careers of women trying to make it in a male-dominated profession. They're also promoting the idea that men cannot control themselves or see women as friends or colleagues, so women bear the responsibility to control the situation.
I've had a lot of male friends, and I thought it was all cool, and then eventually there'd be the moment...
That they had sex.
Where... either we had sex,
exactly,
or they expressed the desire, even after years. And then I was like, okay, friendship over.
So you were clueless, basically. Are you friends with her husband?
No.
No?
Friendly, yes.
Friendly.
Sure.
But no.
Would you be upset if they went and had lunch?
Would I be upset? Would you care? I'd be like, why?
It would be strange...
They try to play it off like it's innocent or that the reason not to do this is just that it's weird. But these are old-fashioned rules, and the reason for them has always been that men aren't expected to behave themselves, so women are supposed to constantly police their behavior. If I thought my man was going to hit on my female friends the second he got alone with one of them, I'd worry about my relationship and trust, not scold my friend if she thought lunch with a man she thinks of as a friend is innocent. These attitudes always result in holding women solely accountable for all sex policing, whereas I tend to think if a married man hits on a woman, that's his fault. The other thing stuff like this does is reinforce the idea that men and women have nothing in common but sex.
One of my girlfriends, her husband and I, one day had to commute to New York City together. It was like a snowstorm, so we were going to the train station together.
And what happened?
I'm going to tell you, we did not have sex, we ended up having breakfast together at some like bagel store in a town, and it was horrible. I had nothing to say to him. He had nothing to say to me.
But you weren't friends.
We were friends as couples.
Some people may think this is cute. But when you propose that men and women are so different they can't even carry on a friendship without having sex, think of the implications. For instance, if you accept that men might have an interest in music, and that's obviously possible since there are so many male musicians and fans, then you're setting yourself up to believe women are incapable of caring about that. Or if women have book clubs, which they often do, the implication is that men aren't readers. And you see that stereotype all the time as well. And now for the Wisdom of Wingnuts, Don't Let the Door Hit Your Butt on the Way Out edition. Rush Limbaugh is making what he thinks are threats if healthcare passes.
I'll just tell you this. If this passes and it's 5 years from now and all that stuff gets implemented, I am leaving the country. I'll go to Costa Rica.
Before that, he was theorizing, though he admitted he didn't know, that doctors would be forced to participate in a federal program. Basically, what this shows is that right-wing radio talk show hosts are blatantly lying about healthcare reform, implying that the changes are going to be more radical than they are. And since Limbaugh will lie about that, I can't imagine he's telling the truth about leaving the country. So we're all so much the poorer for it.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.